After a while I left him. The attendant tells me that he was quiet until just before dawn, and then he began to get uneasy, and at length violent, until at last he fell into a paroxysm which exhausted him so that he swooned into a sort of coma. 3 nights has the same thing happened. Violent all day, then quiet from moonrise to sunrise. I wish I could get some clue to the cause. It would almost seem as if there was some influence which came and went. Happy thought. We shall tonight play sane wits against mad ones. He escaped before without our help, tonight he shall escape with it. We shall give him a chance, and have the men ready to follow in case they are required. 23rd of August. The unexpected always happens. How well Disraeli knew life. Our bird, when he found the cage open, would not fly, so all our subtle arrangements went for naught. At any rate, we have proved one thing, that the spells of quietness last a reasonable time. We shall in future be able to ease his bond for a few hours each day. I have given orders to the night attendant merely to shut him in the padded room, when once he is quiet, until an hour before sunrise. The poor soul's body will enjoy the relief, even if his mind cannot appreciate it. Hark! The unexpected again. I am called. The patient has once more escaped. Later. Another night adventure. Renfield artfully waited until the attendant was entering the room to inspect. Then he dashed out past him and flew down the passage. I sent word for the attendants to follow. Again we went into the ground of the deserted house, and we found him in the same place, pressed against the old chapel door. When he saw me, he became furious, and had not the attendants seized him in time, he would have tried to kill me. As we were holding him, a strange thing happened. He suddenly redoubled his efforts, and then he suddenly grew calm. I looked round instinctively, but could see nothing. Then I caught the patient's eye and followed it, but could trace nothing as it looked into the moonlit sky except a big bat, which was flapping its silent and ghostly way to the west. Bats usually wheel and flit about, but this one seemed to go straight on, as if it knew where it was bound for, or had some intention of its own. The patient grew calmer every instant, and presently said, "You needn't tie me. I shall go quietly." Without trouble, we came back to the house. I feel there is something ominous in his calm, and shall not forget this night. Lucy Westenra's Diary. Hillingham, 24th of August. I must imitate Mina, and keep writing things down. Then we can have long talks when we do meet. I wonder when it will be. I wish she were with me again, for I feel so unhappy. Last night I seemed to be dreaming again, just as I was at Whitby. Perhaps it is the change of air, or getting home again. It is all dark and horrid to me, for I can remember nothing. But I am full of vague fear, and I feel so weak and worn out. When Arthur came to lunch, he looked quite grieved when he saw me, and I hadn't the spirit to be cheerful. I wonder if I could sleep in Mother's room tonight. I shall make an excuse and try. 25th of August. Another bad night. Mother did not seem to take to my proposal. She seems not too well herself, and doubtless she fears to worry me. I tried to keep awake and succeeded for a while, but when the clock struck 12 it waked me from a doze, so I must have been falling asleep. There was a sort of scratching or flapping at the window, but I did not mind it, and as I remember no more, I suppose I must then have fallen asleep. More bad dreams. I wish I could remember them. This morning I am horribly weak. My face is ghastly pale, and my throat pains me. It must be something wrong with my lungs, for I don't seem ever to get air enough. I shall try to cheer up when Arthur comes, or else I know he will be miserable to see me so. Letter. Arthur Holmwood to Dr. Seward. Albemarle Hotel, 31st of August. My dear Jack, I want you to do me a favour. Lucy is ill. That is, she has no special disease, but she looks awful, and is getting worse every day. I have asked her if there is any cause. I do not dare to ask her mother, for to disturb the poor lady's mind about her daughter in her present state of health would be fatal. Mrs. Westenra has confided to me that her doom is spoken, disease of the heart, though poor Lucy does not know it yet. I am sure that there is something preying on my dear girl's mind. I am almost distracted when I think of her. To look at her gives me a pang. I told her I should ask you to see her, and though she demurred at first—I know why, old fellow—she finally consented. It will be a painful task for you, I know, old friend, but it is for her sake, and I must not hesitate to ask or you to act. You are to come to lunch at Hillingham tomorrow 2 o'clock, so as not to arouse any suspicion in Mrs. Westenra, and after lunch Lucy will take an opportunity of being alone with you. I shall come in for tea, and we can go away together. I am filled with anxiety and want to consult with you alone as soon as I can after you have seen her. Do not fail. Arthur. Telegram. Arthur Homewood to Seward. 1st September. Am summoned to see my father, who is worse. Am writing. Write me fully by tonight's post to ring. Wire me, if necessary. Letter from Dr. Seward to Arthur Homewood. 2nd of September. My dear old fellow, with regard to Miss Westenra's health, I hasten to let you know at once that, in my opinion, there is not any functional disturbance or any malady that I know of. At the same time, I am not by any means satisfied with her appearance. She is woefully different from what she was when I saw her last. Of course, you must bear in mind that I did not have full opportunity of examination, such as I would wish. Our very friendship makes a little difficulty which not even medical science or custom can bridge over. I had better tell you exactly what happened, leaving you to draw, in a measure, your own conclusions. I shall then say what I have done and propose doing. I found Miss Westenra in seemingly gay spirits. Her mother was present, and in a few seconds I made up my mind that she was trying all she knew to mislead her mother and prevent her from being anxious. I have no doubt she guesses, if she does not know, what need of caution there is. We lunched alone, and as we all exerted ourselves to be cheerful, we got, as some kind of reward for our labours, some real cheerfulness amongst us. Then Mrs. Westenra went to lie down, and Lucy was left with me. We went into her boudoir, and till we got there her gaiety remained, for the servants were coming and going. As soon as the door was closed, however, the mask fell from her face, and she sank down into a chair with a great sigh, and hid her eyes with her hand. When I saw that her high spirits had failed, I at once took advantage of her reaction to make a diagnosis. She said to me very sweetly, "I cannot tell you how I loathe talking about myself." I reminded her that a doctor's confidence was sacred, but that you were grievously anxious about her. She caught on to my meaning at once and settled that matter in a word. "Tell Arthur everything you choose. I do not care for myself, but all for him. So I am quite free." I could easily see that she is somewhat bloodless, but I could not see the usual anemic signs, and by a chance I was actually able to test the quality of her blood, for in opening a window which was stiff, a cord gave way, and she cut her hand slightly with broken glass. It was a slight matter in itself, but it gave me an evident chance, and I secured a few drops of the blood and have analysed them. The qualitative analysis gives a quite normal condition, and shows, I should infer, in itself a vigorous state of health. In other physical matters I was quite satisfied that there is no need for anxiety. But as there must be a cause somewhere, I have come to the conclusion that it must be something mental. She complains of difficulty in breathing satisfactorily at times, and of heavy, lethargic sleep, with dreams that frighten her, but regarding which she can remember nothing. She says that as a child she used to walk in her sleep, and that when in Whitby the habit came back, and at once she walked out in the night and went to the East Cliff, where Miss Murray found her. But she assures me that of late the habit has not returned. I am in doubt, and so have done the best thing I know of. I have written to my old friend and master, Professor Van Helsing, of Amsterdam, who knows as much about obscure diseases as anyone in the world. I have asked him to come over, and as you told me that all things were to be at your charge, I have mentioned to him who you are, and your relations to Miss Westenra. This, my dear fellow, is only in obedience to your wishes, for I am only too proud and happy to do anything I can for her. Van Helsing would, I know, do anything for me for a personal reason, so no matter on what ground he comes, we must accept his wishes. He is a seemingly arbitrary man, but this is because he knows what he is talking about better than anyone else. He is a philosopher and a metaphysician, and one of the most advanced scientists of his day, and he has, I believe, an absolutely open mind. This, with an iron nerve, a temper of the ice brook, an indomitable resolution, self-command and toleration exalted from virtues to blessings, and the kindest and truest heart that beats, these form his equipment for the noble work that he is doing for mankind, work both in theory and practice, for his views are as wide as his all-embracing sympathy, I tell you these facts that you may know why I have such confidence in him. I have asked him to come at once. I shall see Miss Westenra tomorrow again. She is to meet me at the stores, so that I may not alarm her mother by too early a repetition of my call. Yours always, John Seward. Letter, Abraham Van Helsing, M.D., Doctor of Philosophy, Doctor of Literature, etc., etc., to Dr. Seward. 2nd September. My good friend, when I have received your letter, I am already coming to you. By good fortune, I can leave just at once, without wrong to any of those who have trusted me. A fortune other than it were bad for those who have trusted, for I come to my friend when he called me to aid those he holds dear. Tell your friend that when that time you suck from my wound so swiftly the poison of the gangrene from that knife that our other friend, too nervous, let slip, you did more for him when he wants my aids, and you call for them, than all his great fortune could do. But it is pleasure added to do for him, your friend. It is to you that I come. Have then rooms for me at the Great Eastern Hotel, so that I may be near to hand. And please it so arrange that we may see the young lady not too late on tomorrow, for it is likely that I may have to return here that night. But if need be, I shall come again in 3 days and stay longer if I must. Till then, good-bye, my friend John. Van Helsing. Letter, Dr. Seward, to the Honourable Arthur Holmwood. 3rd of September. My dear Art, Van Helsing has come and gone. He came on with me to Hillingham and found that, by Lucy's discretion, her mother was lunching out, so that we were alone with her. Van Helsing made a very careful examination of the patient. He is to report to me, and I shall advise you, for of course I was not present all the time. He is, I fear, much concerned, but says he must think. When I told him of our friendship and how you trust to me in the matter, he said, "You must tell him all you think. Tell him what I think, if you can guess it, if you will. Nay, I am not jesting. This is no jest, but life and death, perhaps more." I asked what he meant by that, for he was very serious. This was when we had come back to town, and he was having a cup of tea before starting on his return to Amsterdam. He would not give me any further clue. You must not be angry with him, Art, because his very reticence means that all his brains are working for her good. He will speak plainly enough when the time comes, be sure. So I told him I would simply write an account of our visit, just as if I were doing a descriptive special article for the Daily Telegraph. He seemed not to notice, but remarked that the smuts in London were not quite so bad as they used to be when he was a student here. I am to get his report tomorrow, if he can possibly make it. In any case, I am to have a letter. Well, as to the visit, Lucy was more cheerful than on the day I first saw her, and certainly looked better. She had lost something of the ghastly look that so upset you, and her breathing was normal. She was very sweet to the professor, as she always is, and tried to make him feel at ease, though I could see that the poor girl was making a hard struggle for it. I believe Van Helsing saw it, too, for I saw the quick look under his bushy brows that I knew of old. Then he began to chat of all things except ourselves and diseases, and with such an infinite geniality that I could see poor Lucy's pretense of animation merge into reality. Then, without any seeming change, he brought the conversation gently round to his visit, and suavely said, "My dear young miss, I have the so great pleasure, because you are much beloved. That is much, my dear, even were there that which I do not see. They told me you were in the spirit, and that you were of a ghastly pale. To them I say, poof!" And he snapped his fingers at me and went on, "But you and I shall show them how wrong they are." "How can he?" And he pointed at me with the same look and gesture as that with which once he pointed me out to his class, on or rather after a particular occasion which he never fails to remind me of. "Nor anything of a young lady's. He has his madmans to play with, and to bring them back to happiness and to those that love them. It is much to do, and oh, but there are rewards, in that we can bestow such happiness. But the young ladies, he has no wife nor daughter, and the young do not tell themselves to the young, but to the old, like me, who have known so many sorrows, and the causes of them. So, my dear, we will send him away to smoke the cigarette in the garden, whilst you and I have little talk all to ourselves." I took the hint and strolled about, and presently the professor came to the window and called me in. He looked grave, but said, "I have made careful examination, but there is no functional cause. With you I agree that there has been much blood lost. It has been, but is not. But the conditions of her are in no way anemic. I have asked her to send me her maid, that I may ask just one or two questions, that so I may not chance to miss nothing. I know well what she will say, and yet there is cause. There is always cause for everything. I must go back home and think. You must send to me the telegram every day, and if there be cause, I shall come again. The disease, for not to be all well is a disease, interests me, and the sweet young dear, she interests me too. She charmed me, and for her, if not for you or disease, I come. As I tell you, he would not say a word more, even when we were alone. And so now, Art, you know all I know. I shall keep stern watch. I trust your poor father is rallying. It must be a terrible thing to you, my dear old fellow, to be placed in such a position between two people who are both so dear to you. I know your idea of duty to your father, and your right to stick to it. But if need be, I shall send you word to come at once to Lucy, so do not be over-anxious unless you hear from me. Dr. Seward's Diary, 4th of September. Zoophagus patient still keeps up our interest in him. He had only one outburst, and that was yesterday at an unusual time. Just before the stroke of noon he began to grow restless. The attendant knew the symptoms, and at once summoned aid. Fortunately the men came at a run, and were just in time, for at the stroke of noon he became so violent that it took all their strength to hold him. In about 5 minutes, however, he began to get more and more quiet, and finally sank into a sort of melancholy, in which state he has remained up to now. The attendant tells me that his screams, whilst in the paroxysm, were really appalling. I found my hands full when I got in, attending to some of the other patients who were frightened by him. Indeed, I can quite understand the effect, for the sounds disturbed even me, though I was some distance away. It is now after the dinner hour at the asylum, and as yet my patient sits in a corner brooding, with a dull, sullen, woebegone look in his face, which seems rather to indicate than to show something directly. I cannot quite understand it. Later. Another change in my patient. At 5 o'clock I looked in on him and found him seemingly as happy and contented as he used to be. He was catching flies and eating them, and was keeping note of his capture by making nail marks on the edge of the door between the ridges of padding. When he saw me he came over, and apologized for his bad conduct, and asked me in a very humble, cringing way to be let back to his own room, and to have his notebook again. I thought it well to humour him, so he is back in his room, with the window open. He has the sugar of his tea spread out on the window-sill, and is reaping quite a harvest of flies. He is not now eating them, but putting them in a box, as of old, and is already examining the corners of his room to find a spider. I try to get him to talk about the past few days, for any clue of his thoughts would be of immense help to me, but he would not rise. For a moment or two he looked very sad, and said in a sort of far-away voice, as though saying it rather to himself than to me, "All over, all over. He has deserted me. No hope for me now, unless I do it for myself." Then suddenly turning to me in a resolute way, he said, "Doctor, won't you be very good to me and let me have a little more sugar? I think it would be good for me." "And the flies?" I said. "Yes, the flies like it too, and I like the flies. Therefore I like it." And there are people who know so little as to think that madmen do not argue. I procured him a double supply, and left him as happy a man as, I suppose, any in the world. I wish I could fathom his mind. Midnight. Another change in him. I had been to see Miss Westenra, whom I found much better, and had just returned, and was standing at our own gate, looking at the sunset, when once more I heard him yelling. As his room is on this side of the house, I could hear it better than in the morning. It was a shock to me to turn from the wonderful smoky beauty of a sunset over London, with its lurid lights and inky shadows, and all the marvellous tints that come on foul clouds even as on foul water, and to realise all the grim sternness of my own cold stone building, with its wealth of breathing misery, and my own desolate heart to endure it all. I reached him just as the sun was going down, and from his window saw the red disk sink. As it sank he became less and less frenzied, and just as it dipped he slid from the hands that held him, an inert mass, on the floor. It is wonderful, however, what intellectual recuperative power lunatics have, for within a few minutes he stood up quite calmly and looked around him. I signalled to the attendants not to hold him, for I was anxious to see what he would do. He went straight over to the window and brushed out the crumbs of sugar. Then he took his fly-box and emptied it outside and threw away the box. Then he shut the window and, crossing over, sat down on his bed. All this surprised me, so I asked him, "Are you not going to keep flies any more?"
"No," said he. "I'm sick of all that rubbish."
He certainly is a wonderfully interesting study. I wish I could get some glimpse of his mind, or of the cause of his sudden passion. Stop. There may be a clue after all. If we can find why today his paroxysms came on at high noon and at sunset, can it be that there is a malign influence of the sun at periods which affects certain natures, as at times the moon does others? We shall see. Telegram, Seward, London to Van Helsing, Amsterdam, 4th of September. Patient still better today. Telegram, Seward, London to Van Helsing, Amsterdam, 5th of September. Patient greatly improved. Good appetite, sleeps naturally, good spirits, colour coming back. Telegram, Seward, London to Van Helsing, Amsterdam, 6th of September. Terrible change for the worse. Come at once, do not lose an hour. I hold over telegram to Homewood till have seen you. Chapter 10. Letter, Dr. Seward to the Honourable Arthur Homewood, 6th of September. My dear Art, my news today is not so good. Lucy this morning had gone back a bit. There is, however, one good thing which has arisen from it. Mrs. Westenra was naturally anxious concerning Lucy and has consulted me professionally about her. I took advantage of the opportunity and told her that my old master, Van Helsing, the great specialist, was coming to stay with me, and that I would put her in his charge conjointly with myself, so now we can come and go without alarming her unduly, for a shock to her would mean sudden death, and this, in Lucy's weak condition, might be disastrous to her. We are hedged in with difficulties, all of us, my poor old fellow, but please God we shall come through them all right. If any need, I shall write, so that if you do not hear from me, take it for granted that I am simply waiting for news. In haste, yours ever, John Seward. Dr. Seward's Diary. 7th of September. The first thing Van Helsing said to me when we met at Liverpool Street was, "Have you said anything to our young friends, a lover of her?" "No," I said. "I waited till I had seen you, as I said in my telegram. I wrote him a letter simply telling him that you were coming, as Miss Westenra was not so well, and that I should let him know if need be."
"Right, my friend," he said. "Quite right. Better he not know as yet. Perhaps he shall never know. I pray so, but if it be needed, then he shall know all. And, my good friend John, let me caution you. You deal with the madmen. All men are mad in some way or the other. And inasmuch as you deal discreetly with your madmen, so deal with God's madmen, too, the rest of the world. You tell not your madmen what you do, nor why you do it. You tell them not what you think. So you shall keep knowledge in its place, where it may rest, where it may gather its kind around it and breed. You and I shall keep as yet what we know here and here." He touched me on the heart and on the forehead, and then touched himself the same way. "I have for myself thoughts at the present. Later I shall unfold to you." "Why not now?" I asked. "It may do some good. We may arrive at some decision." He stopped and looked at me and said, "My friend John, when the corn is grown, even before it has ripened, while the milk of its mother earth is in him and the sunshine has not yet begun to paint him with his gold, the husbandman he pulls the ear and rub him between his rough hands and blow away the green chaff and say to you, 'Look, his good corn, he will make good crop when the time comes.'"
I did not see the application and told him so. For reply he reached over and took my ear in his hand and pulled it playfully, as he used long ago to do at lectures, and said,
"The good husbandman tell you so then, because he knows, but not till then. But you do not find the good husbandman dig up his planted corn to see if he grow. That is for the children who play at husbandry, and not for those who take it as of the work of their life. See you now, friend John, I have sown my corn, and nature has her work to do in making it sprout. If he sprout at all, there's some promise, and I wait till the ear begins to swell."
He broke off, for he evidently saw that I understood. Then he went on, and very gravely,
"You were always a careful student, and your case-book was ever more full than the rest. You were only student then, now you are master, and I trust that good habit have not fail. Remember, my friend, that knowledge is stronger than memory, and we should not trust the weaker. Even if you have not kept the good practice, let me tell you that this case of our dear miss is one that may be, mind, I say may be, of such interest to us and others that all the rest may not make him kick the beam, as your people say. Take then good note of it. Nothing is too small. I counsel you put down in record even your doubts and surmises. Hereafter it may be of interest to you to see how true you guess. We learn from failure, not from success."
When I described Lucy's symptoms, the same as before, but definitely more marked, he looked very grave but said nothing. He took with him a bag in which were many instruments and drugs. "The ghastly paraphernalia of our beneficial trade," as he once called in one of his lectures, the equipment of a professor of the healing craft. When we were shown in, Mrs. Westenra met us. She was alarmed, but not nearly so much as I expected to find her. Nature, in one of her beneficent moods, had ordained that even death has some antidote to its own terrors. Here, in a case where any shock may prove fatal, matters are so ordered that, from some cause or other, the things not personal, even the terrible change in her daughter to whom she is so attached, do not seem to reach her. It is something like the way Dame Nature gathers round a foreign body an envelope of some insensitive tissue which can protect from evil that which it would otherwise harm by contact. If this be an ordered selfishness, then we should pause before we condemn any one of the vice of egoism, for there may be deeper roots for its causes than we have knowledge of. I used my knowledge of this phase of spiritual pathology, and laid down a rule that she should not be present with Lucy, or think of her illness, more than was absolutely required. She assented readily, so readily that I saw again the hand of nature fighting for life. Van Helsing and I were shown up to Lucy's room. If I was shocked when I saw her yesterday, I was horrified when I saw her today. She was ghastly, chalkily pale. The red seemed to have gone even from her lips and gums, and the bones of her face stood out prominently. Her breathing was painful to see or hear. Van Helsing's face grew set as marble, and his eyebrows converged till they almost touched over his nose. Lucy lay motionless and did not seem to have strength to speak, so for a while we were all silent. Then Van Helsing beckoned to me, and we went gently out of the room. The instant we had closed the door, he stepped quickly along the passage to the next door, which was open. Then he pulled me quickly in with him and closed the door.
"My God!" he said. "This is dreadful! There is no time to be lost. She will die for sheer want of blood to keep the heart's action as it should be. There must be a transfusion of blood at once. Is it you or me?"
"I am younger and stronger, Professor. It must be me."
"Then get ready at once. I will bring up my bag. I am prepared."
I went downstairs with him, and as we were going there was a knock at the hall door. When we reached the hall the maid had just opened the door, and Arthur was stepping quickly in. He rushed up to me, saying in an eager whisper,
"Jack, I was so anxious. I read between the lines of your letter and have been in an agony. The dad was better, so I ran down here to see for myself. Is not that gentleman Dr. Van Helsing? I'm so thankful to you, sir, for coming."
When first the professor's eye had lit upon him, he had been angry at any interruption at such a time, but now, as he took in his stalwart proportions and recognized the strong young manhood which seemed to emanate from him, his eyes gleamed. Without a pause he said to him gravely as he held out his hand,
"Sir, you have come in time. You are the lover of our dear miss. She is bad, very, very bad. Nay, my child, do not go like that."
For he suddenly grew pale and sat down in a chair, almost fainting.
"You are to help. You can do more than any that live, and your courage is your best help."
"What can I do?"
asked Arthur hoarsely.
"Tell me, and I shall do it. My life is hers, and I would give the last drop of blood in my body for her."
The professor has a strongly humorous side, and I could from old detect a trace of its origin in his answer.
My young sir, I do not ask so much as that. Not the last.
What shall I do?
There was fire in his eyes, and his open nostrils quivered with intent. Van Helsing slapped him on the shoulder.
Come, he said. You are a man, and it is a man we want. You are better than me, better than my friend John.
Arthur looked bewildered, and the professor went on by explaining in a kindly way,
Young miss is bad, very bad. She wants blood, and blood she must have or die. My friend John and I have consulted, and we are about to perform what we call transfusion of blood, to transfer from full veins of one to the empty veins which pine for him. John was to give his blood, as he is the more young and strong than me. Here Arthur took my hand and wrung it hard in silence.
But now you are here. You are more good than us, old or young, who toil much in the world of thought. Our nerves are not so calm, and our blood not so bright as yours.
Arthur turned to him and said,
If you only knew how gladly I would die for her, you would understand.
He stopped, with a sort of choke in his voice.
Good boy, said Van Helsing. In the not so far off, you will be happy that you have done all for her you love. Come now and be silent. You shall kiss her once before it is done, but then you must go, and you must leave at my sign. Say no word to Madame. You know how it is with her. There must be no shock. Any knowledge of this would be one. Come.
We all went up to Lucy's room. Arthur, by direction, remained outside. Lucy turned her head and looked at us, but said nothing. She was not asleep, but she was simply too weak to make the effort. Her eyes spoke to us, that was all. Van Helsing took some things from his bag and laid them on a little table, out of sight. Then he mixed a narcotic, and coming over to the bed, said cheerily,
Now, little miss, here is your medicine. Drink it off like a good child. See, I lift you so that to swallow is easy. Yes.
She had made the effort with success. It astonished me how long the drug took to act. This, in fact, marked the extent of her weakness. The time seemed endless until sleep began to flicker in her eyelids. At last, however, the narcotic began to manifest its potency, and she fell into a deep sleep. When the professor was satisfied, he called Arthur into the room and bade him strip off his coat. Then he added,
You may take that one little kiss as I bring over the table. Friend John, help to me.
So neither of us looked whilst he bent over her. Van Helsing, turning to me, said,
He is so young and strong and of blood so pure that we need not defibrinate it.
Then with swiftness, but with absolute method, Van Helsing performed the operation. As the transfusion went on, something like life seemed to come back to poor Lucy's cheeks, and through Arthur's growing pallor the joy of his face seemed absolutely to shine. After a bit I began to grow anxious, for the loss of blood was telling on Arthur, strong man as he was. It gave me an idea of what a terrible strain Lucy's system must have undergone, that what weakened Arthur only partially restored her. But the professor's face was set, and he stood watch in hand, and with his eyes fixed now on the patient and now on Arthur. I could hear my own heart beat. Presently he said in a soft voice,
Do not stir an instant. It is enough. You attend him. I will look to her.
When all was over, I could see how much Arthur was weakened. I dressed the wound and took his arm to bring him away. When Van Helsing spoke without turning round, the man seemed to have eyes in the back of his head.
The brave lover, I think, deserve another kiss, which he shall have presently.
And as he had now finished his operation, he adjusted the pillow to the patient's head. As he did so, the narrow black velvet band, which she seemed always to wear round her throat, buckled with an old diamond buckle which her lover had given her, was dragged a little up and showed a red mark on her throat. Arthur did not notice it. But I could hear the deep hiss of indrawn breath, which is one of Van Helsing's ways of betraying emotion. He said nothing at the moment, but turned to me, saying,
Now take down our brave young lover, give him of the port wine, and let him lie down a while. He must then go home and rest, sleep much and eat much, that he may be recruited of what he has so given to his love. He must not stay here. Hold, a moment. I may take it, sir, that you are anxious of results. Then bring it with you that in all ways the operation is successful. You have saved her life this time, and you can go home and rest easy in mind that all that can be is. I shall tell her all when she is well. She shall love you none the less for what you have done. Goodbye.
When Arthur had gone, I went back to the room. Lucy was sleeping gently, but her breathing was stronger. I could see the counterpane move as her breast heaved. By the bedside sat Van Helsing, looking at her intently. The velvet band again covered the red mark. I asked the professor in a whisper,
"What do you make of that mark on her throat?"
"What do you make of it?"
"I have not seen it yet,"
I answered, and then and there proceeded to loose the band. Just over the external jugular vein there were two punctures. Not large, but wholesome-looking. There was no sign of disease, but the edges were white and worn-looking, as if by some trituration. It at once occurred to me that this wound, or whatever it was, might be the means of that manifest loss of blood, but I abandoned the idea as soon as formed, for such a thing could not be. The whole bed would have been drenched to a scarlet with the blood which the girl must have lost to leave such a pallor as she had before the transfusion.
"Well?"
said Van Helsing. "Well," said I, "I can make nothing of it." The professor stood up.
"I must go back to Amsterdam tonight," he said. "There are books and things there which I want. You must remain here all the night, and you must not let your sight pass from her."
"Shall I have a nurse?" I asked. "We are the best nurses, you and I. You keep watch all night, see that she is well fed, and that nothing disturbs her. You must not sleep all the night. Later on we can sleep, you and I. I shall be back as soon as possible, and then we may begin."
"May begin?" I said. "What on earth do you mean?"
"We shall see," he answered as he hurried out.
He came back a moment later and put his head inside the door and said, with warning finger held up,
"Remember, she is your charge. If you leave her and harm befall, you shall not sleep easy hereafter."
Dr. Seward's diary continued. 8th of September. I sat up all night with Lucy. The opiate worked itself off towards dusk, and she waked naturally. She looked a different being from what she had been before the operation. Her spirits even were good, and she was full of a happy vivacity, but I could see evidences of the absolute prostration which she had undergone. When I told Mrs. Westerner that Dr. Van Helsing had directed that I should sit up with her, she almost pooh-poohed the idea, pointing out her daughter's renewed strength and excellent spirits. I was firm, however, and made preparations for my long vigil. When her maid had prepared her for the night, I came in, having in the meantime had supper, and took a seat by the bedside. She did not in any way make objection, but looked at me gratefully whenever I caught her eye. After a long spell she seemed sinking off to sleep, but with an effort seemed to pull herself together and shook it off. This was repeated several times, with greater effort, and with shorter pauses as the time moved on. It was apparent that she did not want to sleep, so I tackled the subject at once. "You do not want to go to sleep?"
"No, I am afraid."
"Afraid to go to sleep? Why so? It is the boon we all crave for."
"Not if you were like me. If sleep was to you a presage of horror."
"A presage of horror? What on earth do you mean?"
"I don't know. Oh, I don't know. And that is what is so terrible. All this weakness comes to me in sleep, until I dread the very thought."
"But, my dear girl, you may sleep tonight. I am here watching you, and I can promise that nothing will happen."
"Ah, I can trust you."
I seized the opportunity and said, "I promise you that if I see any evidence of bad dreams, I will wake you at once."
"You will? Oh, will you really? How good you are to me! Then I will sleep."
And almost at the word she gave a deep sigh of relief and sank back asleep. All night long I watched by her. She never stirred, but slept on and on, in a deep, tranquil, life-giving, health-giving sleep. Her lips were slightly parted, and her breast rose and fell with the regularity of a pendulum. There was a smile on her face, and it was evident that no bad dreams had come to disturb her peace of mind. In the early morning her maid came, and I left her in her care and took myself back home, for I was anxious about many things. I sent a short wire to Van Helsing and to Arthur, telling them of the excellent result of the operation. My own work, with its manifold arrears, took me all day to clear off. It was dark when I was able to inquire about my zoophagus patient. The report was good. He had been quite quiet for the past day and night. A telegram came from Van Helsing at Amsterdam whilst I was at dinner, suggesting that I should be at Hillingham tonight, as it might be well to be at hand, and stating that he was leaving by the night mail and would join me early in the morning. 9th of September. I was pretty tired and worn out when I got to Hillingham. For 2 nights I had hardly had a wink of sleep, and my brain was beginning to feel that numbness which marks cerebral exhaustion. Lucy was up and in cheerful spirits. When she shook hands with me, she looked sharply in my face and said,
"No sitting up tonight for you. You're worn out. I'm quite well again. Indeed I am. And if there is to be any sitting up, it is I who will sit up with you."
I would not argue the point, but went and had my supper. Lucy came with me, and, enlivened by her charming presence, I made an excellent meal, and had a couple of glasses of the more than excellent port. Then Lucy took me upstairs and showed me a room next her own, where a cosy fire was burning.
"Now," she said, "you must stay here. I shall leave this door open, and my door too. You can lie on the sofa, for I know that nothing would induce any of you doctors to go to bed whilst there is a patient above the horizon. If I want anything, I shall call out, and you can come to me at once."
I could not but acquiesce, for I was dog-tired, and could not have sat up had I tried. So on her renewing her promise to call me if she should want anything, I lay on the sofa and forgot all about everything. Lucy Westerner's Diary.
9th of September. I feel so happy tonight. I've been so miserably weak that to be able to think and move about is like feeling sunshine after a long spell of east wind out of a steel sky. Somehow Arthur feels very, very close to me. I seem to feel his presence warm about me. I suppose it is that sickness and weakness are selfish things, and turn our inner eyes and sympathy on ourselves, whilst health and strength give love rein, and in thought and feeling he can wander where he wills. I know where my thoughts are. If Arthur only knew. My dear, your ears must tingle as you sleep, as mine do waking. Oh, the blissful rest of last night! How I slept with that dear, good Dr. Seward watching me! And tonight I shall not fear to sleep, since he is close at hand and within call. Thank everybody for being so good to me. Thank God. Good night, Arthur.
Dr. Seward's Diary. 10th of September. I was conscious of the professor's hand on my head, and started awake all in a second. That is one of the things we learn in an asylum, at any rate.
"And how is our patient?"
"Well, when I left her, or rather when she left me," I answered.
"Come, let us see," he said,
and together we went into the room. The blind was down, and I went over to raise it gently, whilst Van Helsing stepped with his soft, cat-like tread over to the bed. As I raised the blind, and the morning sunlight flooded the room, I heard the professor's low hiss of inspiration, and knowing its rarity, a deadly fear shot through my heart. As I passed over, he moved back, and his exclamation of horror,
"Gott in Himmel!"
needed no enforcement from his agonized face. He raised his hand and pointed to the bed, and his iron face was drawn and ashen white. I felt my knees begin to tremble. There on the bed, seemingly in a swoon, lay poor Lucy, more horribly white and wan-looking than ever. Even the lips were white, and the gums seemed to have shrunken back from the teeth as we sometimes see in a corpse after a prolonged illness. Van Helsing raised his foot to stamp in anger, but the instinct of his life and all the long years of habit stood to him, and he put it down again softly.
"Quick," he said, "bring the brandy."
I flew to the dining room and returned with a decanter. He wetted the poor white lips with it, and together we rubbed palm and wrist and heart. He felt her heart, and after a few moments of agonizing suspense, said,
"It is not too late. It beats, though but feebly. All our work is undone. We must begin again.
There is no young Arthur here now. I have to call on you yourself this time, friend John."
As he spoke, he was dipping into his bag and producing the instruments for transfusion. I had taken off my coat and rolled up my shirt sleeve. There was no possibility of an opiate just at present, and no need of one, and so without a moment's delay we began the operation. After a time, it did not seem a short time either, for the draining away of one's blood, no matter how willingly it be given, is a terrible feeling, Van Helsing held up a warning finger.
"Do not stir," he said. "But I feel that with growing strength she may wake, and that would make danger, oh, so much danger. But I shall precaution take. I shall give hypodermic injection of morphia."
He proceeded then, swiftly and deftly, to carry out his intent. The effect on Lucy was not bad, for the faint seemed to merge subtly into the narcotic sleep. It was with a feeling of personal pride that I could see a faint tinge of colour steal back into the pallid lips and cheeks. No man knows, till he experiences it, what it is to feel his own life-blood drawn away into the veins of the woman he loves. The professor watched me critically.
"That will do," he said.
"Already?" I remonstrated. "You took a great deal more from art." To which he smiled a sad sort of smile as he replied,
"He is her lover, her fiancé. You have work, much work to do for her and for others, and the present will suffice."
When we stopped the operation, he attended to Lucy whilst I applied digital pressure to my own incision. I lay down whilst I waited his leisure to attend to me, for I felt faint and a little sick. By and by he bound up my wound and sent me downstairs to get a glass of wine for myself. As I was leaving the room, he came after me and half whispered,
"Mind, nothing must be said of this. If our young lover should turn up unexpected as before, no word to him. It would at once frighten him and enjealous him, too. There must be none so."
When I came back, he looked at me carefully and then said,
"You are not much the worse. Go into the room and lie on your sofa and rest a while. Then have much breakfast and come here to me."
I followed out his orders, for I knew how right and wise they were. I had done my part, and now my next duty was to keep up my strength. I felt very weak, and in the weakness lost something of the amazement at what had occurred. I fell asleep on the sofa, however, wondering over and over again how Lucy had made such a retrograde movement, and how she could have been drained of so much blood with no sign anywhere to show for it. I think I must have continued my wonder in my dreams, for sleeping and waking my thoughts always came back to the little punctures in her throat, and the ragged, exhausted appearance of their edges, tiny though they were. Lucy slept well into the day, and when she woke she was fairly well and strong, though not nearly so much as the day before. When Van Helsing had seen her, he went out for a walk, leaving me in charge, with strict injunctions that I was not to leave her for a moment. I could hear his voice in the hall, asking the way to the nearest telegraph office. Lucy chatted with me freely, and seemed quite unconscious that anything had happened. I tried to keep her amused and interested. When her mother came up to see me, she did not seem to notice any change whatever, but said to me gratefully,
"We owe you so much, Dr. Seward, for all you have done. But you really must now take care not to overwork yourself. You are looking pale yourself. You want a wife to nurse and look after you a bit, that you do."
As she spoke, Lucy turned crimson, though it was only momentarily, for her poor wasted veins could not stand for long such an unwanted drain to the head. The reaction came in excessive pallor as she turned imploring eyes on me. I smiled and nodded and laid my finger on my lips. With a sigh she sank back amid her pillows. Van Helsing returned in a couple of hours and presently said to me,
"Now you go home and eat much and drink enough. Make yourself strong. I stay here tonight, and I shall sit up with little miss myself. You and I must watch the case, and we must have none other to know. I have grave reasons. No, do not ask them. Think what you will. Do not fear to think even the most not probable. Good night."
In the hall two of the maids came to me and asked if they or either of them might not sit up with Miss Lucy. They implored me to let them, and when I said it was Dr. Van Helsing's wish that either he or I should sit up, they asked me quite piteously to intercede with the foreign gentleman. I was much touched by their kindness. Perhaps it is because I am weak at present, and perhaps it was on Luce's account that their devotion was manifested, for over and over again have I seen similar instances of woman's kindness. I got back here in time for a late dinner, went my rounds, all well, and set this down whilst waiting for sleep. It is coming. 11th of September. This afternoon I went over to Hillingham, found Van Helsing in excellent spirits, and Lucy much better. Shortly after I had arrived, a big parcel from abroad came for the professor. He opened it with much impressment, assumed, of course, and showed a great bundle of white flowers. "These are for you, Miss Lucy," he said.
"For me? Oh, Dr. Van Helsing!"
"Yes, my dear, but not for you to play with. These are medicines."
Here Lucy made a wry face.
"Nay, but they are not to take in a decoction or in nauseous form, so you need not snub that so charming nose, or I shall point out to my friend Arthur what woes he may have to endure in seeing so much beauty that he so loves so much distort. Aha, my pretty miss, that brings a so nice nose all straight again. This is medicinal, but you do not know how. I put him in your window, I make pretty wreath, and hang him round your neck so that you sleep well. Oh, yes, they, like the lotus flower, make your trouble forgotten. It smells so like the waters of Lethe, and of that fountain of youth that the conquistadores sought for in the Floridas, and find him all too late."
Whilst he was speaking, Lucy had been examining the flowers and smelling them. Now she threw them down, saying with half laughter and half disgust,
"Oh, Professor, I believe you are only putting up a joke on me. Why, these flowers are only common garlic."
To my surprise, Van Helsing rose up and said with all his sternness, his iron jaw set and his bushy eyebrows meeting,
"No trifling with me. I never jest. There is grim purpose in all I do, and I warn you that you do not thwart me. Take care, for the sake of others, if not for your own."
Then seeing poor Lucy scared, as she might well be, he went on more gently,
"Oh, little miss, my dear, do not fear me. I only do for your good, but there is much virtue to you in those so common flower. See, I place them myself in your room. I make myself the wreath that you are to wear. But hush, no telling to others that make so inquisitive questions. We must obey, and silence is a part of obedience, and obedience is to bring you strong and well into loving arms that wait for you. Now sit still a while. Come with me, friend John, and you shall help me deck the room with my garlic, which is all the way from Haarlem, where my friend Vanderpool raise herb in his glass houses all the year. I had to telegraph yesterday, or they would not have been here."
We went into the room, taking the flowers with us. The professor's actions were certainly odd, and not to be found in any pharmacopoeia that I ever heard of. First he fastened up the windows and latched them securely. Next, taking a handful of the flowers, he rubbed them all over the sashes, as though to ensure that every whiff of air that might get in would be laden with the garlic smell. Then, with the wisp, he rubbed all over the jamb of the door, above, below, and at each side, and round the fireplace in the same way. It all seemed grotesque to me, and presently I said, "Well, Professor, I know you always have a reason for what you do, but this certainly puzzles me. It is well we have no sceptic here, or he would say that you are working some spell to keep out an evil spirit."
"Perhaps I am,"
he answered quietly, as he began to make the wreath which Lucy was to wear round her neck. We then waited whilst Lucy made her toilet for the night, and when she was in bed he came and himself fixed the wreath of garlic round her neck. The last words he said to her were,
"Take care you do not disturb it, and even if the room feel close, do not to-night open the window or the door."
"I promise," said Lucy. "And thank you both 1,000 times for all your kindness to me. Oh, what have I done to be blessed with such friends?"
As we left the house in my fly, which was waiting, Van Helsing said,
"To-night I can sleep in peace, and sleep I want. Two nights of travel, much reading in the day between, and much anxiety on the day to follow, and a night to sit up, without to wink. Tomorrow in the morning early you call for me, and we come together to see our pretty miss. So much more strong for my spell, which I have worked."
He seemed so confident that I, remembering my own confidence 2 nights before, and with the baneful result, felt awe and vague terror. It must have been my weakness that made me hesitate to tell it to my friend, but I felt it all the more, like unshed tears. Chapter 11. Lucy Westenra's Diary.
12th of September. How good they all are to me! I quite love that dear Dr. Van Helsing. I wonder why he was so anxious about these flowers. He positively frightened me, he was so fierce. And yet he must have been right, for I feel comfort from them already. Somehow I do not dread being alone tonight, and I can go to sleep without fear. I shall not mind any flapping outside the window. Oh, the terrible struggle that I have had against sleep so often of late, the pain of the sleeplessness, or the pain of the fear of sleep, with such unknown horrors as it has for me. How blessed are some people whose lives have no fears, no dreads, to whom sleep is a blessing that comes nightly and brings nothing but sweet dreams. Well, here I am tonight, hoping for sleep, and lying like Ophelia in the play, with virgin crants and maiden struments. I never liked garlic before, but tonight it is delightful. There is peace in its smell. I feel sleep coming already. Good night, everybody.
Dr. Seward's Diary. 13th of September. Called at the Berkeley and found Van Helsing, as usual, up to time. The carriage ordered from the hotel was waiting. The professor took his bag, which he always brings with him now. Let all be put down exactly. Van Helsing and I arrived at Hillingham at 8 o'clock. It was a lovely morning. The bright sunshine and all the fresh feeling of early autumn seemed like the completion of nature's annual work. The leaves were turning to all kinds of beautiful colours, but had not yet begun to drop from the trees. When we entered, we met Mrs. Westenra coming out of the morning room. She's always an early riser. She greeted us warmly and said,
"You will be glad to know that Lucy is better. The dear child is still asleep. I looked into her room and saw her, but did not go in, lest I should disturb her."
The professor smiled and looked quite jubilant. He rubbed his hands together and said,
"Aha! I thought I had diagnosed the case. My treatment is working."
To which she answered,
"You must not take all the credit to yourself, doctor. Lucy's state this morning is due in part to me."
"How do you mean, ma'am?" said the professor.
"Well, I was anxious about the dear child in the night and went into her room. She was sleeping soundly, so soundly that even my coming did not wake her. But the room was awfully stuffy. There were a lot of those horrible strong-smelling flowers about everywhere, and she had actually a bunch of them round her neck. I feared that the heavy odour would be too much for the dear child in her weak state, so I took them all away and opened a bit of the window to let in a little fresh air. You will be pleased with her, I am sure."
She moved off into her boudoir, where she usually breakfasted early. As she had spoken, I watched the professor's face and saw it turn ashen grey. He had been able to retain his self-command whilst the poor lady was present, for he knew her state and how mischievous a shock would be. He actually smiled on her as he held open the door for her to pass into her room, but the instant she had disappeared he pulled me suddenly and forcibly into the dining-room and closed the door. Then, for the first time in my life, I saw Van Helsing break down. He raised his hands over his head in a sort of mute despair, and then beat his palms together in a helpless way. Finally he sat down on a chair and, putting his hands before his face, began to sob with loud, dry sobs that seemed to come from the very racking of his heart. Then he raised his arms again as though appealing to the whole universe.
"God, God, God," he said, "what have we done? What has this poor thing done that we are so sore beset? Is there fate amongst us still, sent down from the pagan world of old, that such things must be, and in such a way? This poor mother, all unknowing, and all for the best, as she thinks, does such thing as lose her daughter body and soul. And we must not tell her. We must not even warn her, or she die, and then both die. Oh, how we are beset! How are all the powers of the devils against us?"
Suddenly he jumped to his feet.
"Come," he said. "Come, we must see and act. Devils or no devils, or all the devils at once, it matters not. We fight him all the same."
He went to the hall door for his bag, and together we went up to Lucy's room. Once again I drew up the blind whilst Van Helsing went towards the bed. This time he did not start as he looked on the poor face with the same awful waxen pallor as before. He wore a look of stern sadness and infinite pity.
"As I expected,"
he murmured, with that hissing inspiration of his which meant so much. Without a word he went and locked the door, and then began to set out on the little table the instruments for yet another operation of transfusion of blood. I had long ago recognized the necessity, and began to take off my coat, but he stopped me with a warning hand.
"No," he said, "today you must operate. I shall provide. You are weakened already."
As he spoke, he took off his coat and rolled up his shirt sleeve. Again the operation, again the narcotic, again some return of colour to the ashy cheeks, and the regular breathing of healthy sleep. This time I watched while Van Helsing recruited himself and rested. Presently he took an opportunity of telling Mrs. Westenra that she must not remove anything from Lucy's room without consulting him, that the flowers were of medicinal value, and that the breathing of their odour was a part of the system of cure. Then he took over the care of the case himself, saying that he would watch this night and the next, and would send me word when to come. After another hour Lucy waked from her sleep, fresh and bright, and seemingly not much the worse from her terrible ordeal. What does it all mean? I'm beginning to wonder if my long habit of life amongst the insane is beginning to tell upon my own brain. Lucy Westenra's Diary.
17th of September. 4 days and nights of peace. I'm getting so strong again that I hardly know myself. It is as if I had passed through some long nightmare, and had just awakened to see the beautiful sunshine and feel the fresh air of the morning around me. I have a dim half-remembrance of long, anxious times of waiting and fearing, darkness in which there was not even the pain of hope to make present distress more poignant, and then long spells of oblivion, and the rising back to life as a diver coming up through a great press of water. Since, however, Dr. Van Helsing has been with me, all this bad dreaming seems to have passed away. The noises that used to frighten me out of my wits, the flapping against the windows, the distant voices which seemed so close to me, the harsh sounds that came from I know not where and commanded me to do I know not what, have all ceased. I go to bed now without any fear of sleep. I do not even try to keep awake. I have grown quite fond of the garlic, and a boxful arrives for me every day from Haarlem. Tonight Dr. Van Helsing is going away, as he has to be for a day in Amsterdam. But I need not be watched. I am well enough to be left alone. Thank God for Mother's sake, and dear Arthur's, and for all our friends who have been so kind. I shall not even feel the change, for last night Dr. Van Helsing slept in his chair a lot of the time. I found him asleep twice when I awoke, but I did not fear to go to sleep again, although the bowers or bats or something flapped almost angrily against the window panes.
The Pall Mall Gazette, 18th of September. The Escaped Wolf. Perilous Adventure of Our Interviewer. Interview with the Keeper in the Zoological Gardens. After many inquiries and almost as many refusals, and perpetually using the words Pall Mall Gazette as a sort of talisman, I managed to find the keeper of the section of the Zoological Gardens in which the Wolf Department is included. Thomas Bilder lives in one of the cottages in the enclosure behind the Elephant House, and was just sitting down to his tea when I found him. Thomas and his wife are hospitable people, elderly and without children, and if the specimen I enjoyed of their hospitality be of the average kind, their lives must be pretty comfortable. The keeper would not enter on what he called business until the supper was over, and we were all satisfied. Then when the table was cleared and he had lit his pipe, he said,
"Now, sir, you can go on and ask me what you want. You'll excuse me refusing to talk of professional subjects afore meals. I gives the wolves and the jackals and the hyenas in all our section their tea afore I begins to ask them questions."
"How do you mean, ask them questions?" I queried, wishing to get him into a talkative murmur.
"Hitting of them over the head with a pole is one way. Scratching of their ears is another, when gents as is flush wants a bit of a show-off to their gals. I don't so much mind the fust, the hittin' with a pole afore I chucks in their dinner, but I waits till they've had their sherry and coffee, so to speak, afore I tries on with the ear-scratching. Mind you," he added philosophically, "there's a deal of the same nature in us as in them there animals. "'Here's you a-coming and asking of me questions about my business, "'and I that grumpy-like that only for your blooming half-quid "'I'd a seen you blowed fast for I'd answer. "'Not even when you asked me sarcastic-like "'if I'd like you to ask the superintendent "'if you might ask me questions. "'Without offence, did I tell you to go to hell?'